If you like a simple life where someone tells you all the rules and you just have to follow, then this is not the place. If you like things in black and white where someone hands you truth and you just choose to take it, then this is not the place. If you like for things to stay the same, where someone past said, do this, do that, and you just keep tradition, then this is not the place. But if you seek the sense of right that lives behind the rules, and if you see the rainbow range of truths within each truth, and if you choose and seek and think, struggle, wonder, ponder, and if you let things change and grow in ever-unfolding glory, and celebrate the mystery that is beyond all knowing, then here is just the place to be. Let's share and grow together.
Our opening words today are from Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay, The Oversoul. This is the first paragraph. There is a difference between one and another hour of life in their authority and subsequent effect. Our faith comes in moments. Our vice is habitual. Yet there is a depth in those brief moments which constrains us to ascribe more reality to them than to all other experiences.
And here in the center of our service, we take a moment to find ourselves. If you would like to take this time to light a candle for a joy or a concern in your life, to celebrate something, or to struggle to get through it, then please feel free to do so at this time. Or just sit in your seats and think about all of the wonderful and difficult things that we experience as we grow and learn.
Good morning. My name is Peter Tai, and this is my first opportunity to speak to this group. It is a great privilege and a great honor. It is a lot of fun for me to work up a talk before a group like this, and I hope it'll be fun for you as well. My topic for today is renewing our personal images of God. Now, some of you may be agnostics or humanists, or just another way, don't find this topic very intriguing. Well, all I can tell you is back where I came from in Massachusetts, half the fun of going to the church was disagreeing with the sermon. So maybe you could take some consolation in that, and I'm very pleased to take heckling after the service. I'm going to assume that there is some value in going back to our images of God or some transcendent reality. I'm going to assume that most of us who may be quite experienced in life get to the point where we lose some of the vividness of our images of God or of a transcendent reality. I'm quite convinced that as we age, our need for competency, multitasking, and efficiency does a toll on our imagination. Similarly, I think our need for our interest in or our understanding of our sense of enchantment or wonder is sort of drained away by our need for personal achievement. So my idea for this next few minutes, if you wish to follow me in this, is that we can, by thinking back on our own personal images of God or of a transcendent reality, we can make these images more vivid and refresh ourselves. The first image of God is one that is not very popular among Unitarian Universalists. It's the God who apparently is up in the sky and you can talk to on a nightly basis alone. We call this talk prayer. And I think many of us consider this prayer to be sort of asking for gifts or asking for magic. We consider it sort of the silly mentality of Janis Joplin's prayer, "Oh Lord, won't you give me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all have Porsches, I must make amends." Of course, some people do pray like that, but I ask you to sort of shift your approach for a moment consider that maybe we'll call it dialogue with God instead of prayer. So what is a dialogue? It seems a dialogue is a well-respected way of teaching and learning. When you're in a dialogue, you say something. It may be a little tentative, but you hope by sharing it with others and trying to express it, you come to a higher understanding. Now, you may say, well, a dialogue with God is a bit one-sided, but not necessarily. I think some of us have had dialogues with therapists that are a bit one-sided. We find that they are hopefully listening, but not necessarily responding. And our ability to talk during those listening, non-responsive silences often allows us to hear ourselves better and reframe things in a way that we never thought we could. Now, lest we touchy-feely liberals think that therapeutic prayer is something new to us, I'm sorry to tell you that King David got a jump on us by about 3,000 years. Let me show you one of his, what I'll call therapeutic prayers, from Psalm 22. We might call the beginning of this prayer the complaint stage. "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me? My bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted in my breast. Yea, dogs are round about me. A company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet." But then he goes on, makes a sort of paradigm shift, maybe, or has a different approach, and look at the tone at the end of this. "Posterity shall serve him," him being the Lord. "Men shall tell of the Lord to the coming generation and proclaim his deliverance to a people yet unborn, that he has wrought it." So he moved from despair to a sort of joyous anticipation. My contention here is that we could do this ourselves if we listen to what we say and we listen to the silences between what we say. We could sometimes be transformed and uplifted. A second real important value of prayer for me is that it allows us to take note of what we have to be grateful for. In our busy days, we worry more about our work, our family, our needs, our daily logistics, and most of us don't have a regular process, a regular practice, as the Buddhists might say, of bringing forward into our consciousness our sense of gratitude on a daily basis. One more point on prayer comes from my favorite New Age best-selling guru, Caroline Mace. Caroline Mace says that your prayers are always answered, but you have to perk up and listen. And most people don't want to perk up and listen because they want the answer they are asking for, not an answer that might be better for them. More importantly, The answer might be telling them they need to take a risk or improve something that they don't want to do. So since the answer requires things of them they don't want to do, they claim their prayers are not answered. My second image of God I will call the special moments image. And this is, for me, the most compelling of all the images of God I'm going to talk about. Emerson, I think, states this the best, and so I hope you don't mind me rereading this paragraph, because I think it is the most eloquent religious paragraph there ever was. There is a difference between one and another hour of life in their authority and their subsequent effect. Our faith comes in moments. Our vice is habitual. Yet there is a depth in these brief moments which constrains us to ascribe more reality to them than to all other experiences. Similarly, Martin Buber, in his book I and Thou, speaks of the I-thou or I-you relationship as being brief but transforming. What does this mean? To me, it means that we can have a special moment which confounds us and alters our perspective dramatically. It, however, does not contradict our rational insights. We would not be likely to have a special moment and then conclude that Tom DeLay wasn't such a bad guy after all. In fact, these special moments don't give us an all-is-well attitude. Rather, they have a bittersweet character. They are very fleeting, and once you begin to notice and analyze a special moment or an I-thou relationship, it vanishes. Martin Buber says that this vanishing leaves us with a feeling of sublime melancholy. Similarly, Albert Schweitzer writes that in such tragic special moments, life becomes puzzlingly precious. I'm not so sure that it's valuable to share our images of God or special moments with each other. It would be kind of a UU thing to work up an adult RE course where we could make some cards and share our special moments. But I really think that this is something that needs to be done personally and in private. But in order to try to provoke you, I'm going to give you a few of my own, not to sell them, but to in the hopes that it'll help you conjure your own special moments, your own special images of God. One special moment I've had several times in my life is I've spent a few minutes with someone with whom I've had almost no conversation, but somehow sitting there with them, I have an overwhelming sense that we have a bond between the two of us without any conversation. Emerson and others write of another special moment that occurs during convalescence, and he argues that these convalescent moments allow us to renew our creativity and recommit ourselves to life. But different people have different reactions to this. I've never found convalescence to be that way. My memories of convalescence are of a sort of grumpy depression. So you have to work through your own images in your own way, and hopefully it will give you some vividness. Perhaps the most common image, personal image of God, is the image of God in nature. Even such a traditional religious thinker as Reinhold Niebuhr argues that it may very well be our awe-struckness with nature that creates our concept of a personal God. That sort of puts things on its head, doesn't it? We think God created the universe, but maybe it's the transcendent aspects of the universe that give us our conception of God. Certainly Marcus Borg, who was a favorite Christian theologian of mine and a member of the Jesus Seminar, says that it wasn't until he was in his 30s and he had some experiences of nature that he was able to go back to the imagery and content of Christianity. Certainly, this is the way it is with me. I wouldn't be up here today talking if it weren't for my natural images of nature. My interest in nature begot my interest in theology and talking about God. Two of my most important images of nature are the seashore and the sunset. Now, my brother once told me that I could enjoy a sunrise as well if I would only get up early enough. But I'm not sure that's quite right. There is an intensity in the sun of the sun during the sunset, particularly up north where I came from, and when I was younger and had a little more light perception, there was an intensity about a setting sun that is unforgettable. And there's also the sort of bittersweet aspect of the sunset, because it is the end of the day. It is something drawing to a close. And I think these natural things can be very inspiring to us, and they may be our sense of transcendent God. And then there is music as an image for God. As a kid, I was a member of a chorus and took piano lessons. None of that moved me at all. But also in high school, I started listening to classical music, and I found very soon that I had some very special moments. To this day, I find that listening to either recorded music or a live concert takes me out of myself, confounds me, and renews a sense of joy. My favorite piece of all time is Schubert's Ninth Symphony. And I think so highly of this piece that I only will play it once or twice a year. And I don't even have to play it. I don't have to take out a CD. I can just sort of go over it in my mind, and it brings a wonderful sense of joy and excitement and recommitment, sort of. I think that poetry, literature, and art can also be, for people, valuable images of God. And I don't have much to contribute on the subject of art, and I'm not as sensitive to poetry as I would like to be, but I think the advantage of poetry is that it is more or less a succession of images, not linear thought. And so, therefore, it fits into this possible way of finding images. Ultimately, what is the value of being open to these images of God? My answer in words results in a rather bland or trite statement, but I will try anyway. The message of all these images, special images, is that there is more to the story than we know, and that there are more possibilities than we are aware of. I don't think that anyone can be comforted or inspired by these words, but we don't need to be, because this message needs to be processed emotionally, not understood intellectually. I believe that we cannot live a balanced and meaningful life without emotionally believing that there is more to the story and that there are always other possibilities. The emotional understanding of this statement is a necessary backdrop for our daily lives. Without this emotional backdrop, all of the burden and meaning of life needs to be placed on the individual self or ego. This is both more of a burden and more power than the self or ego should have. It is more of a burden because the requirement of constantly improving standards, constantly beating back all addictions, and never compromising one's personal integrity can never be sustained. It is too much power for the self or the ego to have, because it is both, the ego is, both a judge and the implementer of the program. The self or ego becomes center stage. I think we all know that we cannot be our true selves unless we can, from time to time, step back from our plans, will, and intentions. But if duty, character, and grit and determination are all we have to live for, there is no room to step back from this self. William James put it another way. If stoic courage is what is holding us together, we must fall apart as soon as we lose our good health. A dying person, on the other hand, who has a religious perspective, seems to be able to maintain a sense of enchantment and joy to the end. But we need a sense of enchantment and joy, not just at the end, but all throughout our lives, to keep our sense of willful striving in check. I will conclude this talk by stating this proposition one more time, another way. We cannot truly be of service to others unless we are truly glad to be here ourselves. We cannot fashion this gladness with our own hands. We must discover and rediscover it throughout our lives by listening and being open to our images of God. Thank you very much.